The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to graphic designer Arlen Schumer, who just published a deluxe revised edition of his book, The Silver Age of Comic Book Art. It is a stunningly beautiful, oversized book packed with the greatest comic art of the 1960s as rendered by Neil Adams, Jim Steranko, Carmine Infantino, Gene Colan, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, and Gil Kane. Stick around, but prepare your eyeballs for four-color overload. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media Interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of comic book fans prone to arguing because only they can determine who the best artists truly were in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Want to give your eyeballs a real treat? Pick up a copy of Arlen Schumer's The Silver Age of Comic Book Art, which was recently released in a revised edition, and turn to any page. And I mean any page. Wherever your eyes go, they will discover a stunningly well-curated tour through the DC and Marvel pop art of the 1960s, the word balloons now filled not with superhero dialogue, but with fine art narrative and discussion from Schumer and the artists themselves. Here's Steve Ditko on his ethereal Doctor Strange images. Style is not what you do, but how you handle it. Whatever I draw doesn't have to look like anything that ever existed. Think The Flash looks pretty cool as depicted on the CW TV series? Check out Carmine Infantino's take on the Scarlet Speedster in the 1960s and hear about him in the artist's own words. Movement. That's what The Flash was all about. That's what made the character. He was tough to do because of the constant speed. Every page I'd have constant motion. Even when it was quiet, you'd need motion. And speaking of TV, would ABC have ever invested millions in producing Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. if Jim Steranko hadn't made Nick Fury so damn cool? When I took S.H.I.E.L.D. on, Steranko says, Fury was simply an older version of his wartime persona. Rumpled, cigar-chomping, unshaven. I cleaned him up, gave him the kinky black leather zip suit, rippling with clips, buttons, cartridge belts, and the shoulder holster, so he could compete visually with Marvel superheroes. I gave him a personality and a sex life. I'm telling you, true believers, you gotta get this book. So who is Arlen Schumer? He's a graphic designer, a comic book historian, and a member of the Society of Illustrators, one who makes his living creating comic book style illustrations for advertising and editorial usage. And with that, Arlen Schumer, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks for having me, Bob. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Love the background, all the stuff behind you.
It's my Batman cave. That's what I call it.
All right. So listen,
the stuff you can't see is like in front of me, this stuff.
All right.
you know, all around me.
Well, Arlen, there is no shortage of comic book history books, and I know, as you know, because I wrote one myself, but yours carves out kind of a spectacular and special niche for itself, the Silver Age. Can you tell us a little bit about how you settled on this area, this era, and the artists that you singled out for inclusion?
Well, to begin with, every comic book history book I ever have had was text heavy with miniature reproductions. And I'm an artist. I learned to become an artist because of the comic book art that influenced me as a kid, that were these artists from the 1960s. So I was like, where is the comic book history book that's about the artwork? And even though, you know, I like some Golden Age reprints and things like that, most of the history books were about the Golden Age. There was very little about the Silver Age itself and about the artists that influenced me. I mean, we love Will Eisner. We love Dick Sprang. We love some of the 1940s artists. But I always thought as a kid growing up in the 60s that that art was kind of crude. I don't think comic book art, mainstream DC Marvel comic book art, really came of age until the 60s. And that was, you know, the Silver Age. And it came down to, if you want something done right, do it yourself. So I had to do the first comic book art history book that's really about the art. As Gil Kane said, I think I quote him in the table of contents, it's always been about the art.
Would you disagree that maybe the EC comics of the 50s were kind of the beginning of that maturation for comics?
Well, it was the illustrator was the star. But EC Comics themselves, with the Leroy lettering, the very heavily written, overwritten captions by Feldstein and Gaines, pre-ruling out the pages for the artists to fill in. EC are beautifully illustrated comics, but they're not what I would really call the synthesis of word and picture. Got now, it. That comes in the 60s when guys like Steranko and Adams hit. Kubert was playing around with that. Obviously, Eisner did it in the 1940s. But to me, the art of illustration and the art of comic book storytelling itself comes of age in the Silver Age in the 1960s if you cover the span of the artists the way I kind of chronologically align them, beginning with Infantino and ending with Neil Adams.
Now, it's interesting because on first thought when I open the book and I see Infantino, I'm like, Carmine Infantino in this group. But the way you present his
Absolutely.
Work – Yeah, I mean, it's hard to deny his belonging in this group.
He was so instrumental as the signifier of the DC Silver Age look, not only because he did The Flash, which was the keynote superhero, the first pop culture reboot, the way we talk about reboots, the bringing the introduction of the Infantino-designed Flash in 1956 is the beginning of the Silver Age, but as an artist – not only does he do Flash, and then eventually, of course, he saves Batman along with Julius Schwartz, the editor, in 1964, but his covers are so successful that he's the first artist to get promoted in 1967 to become the, like in a sense, art director and then eventually publisher. You know, nowadays you've got Joe Quesada, an artist in the editorial helm at Marvel or who's ever over there, but I mean he's there, but the first artist to do that was Infantino. So in terms of the look of the DC end of the Silver Age, it's really Infantino setting the style first as the artist and illustrator and then as the eventual guy that steered DC from out of the Silver Age into the 1970s. And obviously for better or for worse, his reign was very controversial. But you know what I mean? That trajectory of Infantino, how do you not begin the Silver Age if not on him?
Well, thinking about it, I guess Infantino made it possible some 40 years later, is that about right? I think my math is about right, for Jim Lee to follow in his footsteps.
Well, but this is what I'm saying. But yeah. Lee follows Quesada.
Right.
I'm saying Quesada was the first artist in the modern times since Infantino to be running the look or the style and the content of a comic book company. Mm. You know, it's sort of like in ad agencies, Bob. I was an art director and a copywriter, like a hybrid, because I always wrote and did my own stuff. But ad agencies were sometimes dominated by the copy end. And the art directors, you know, the copywriters were elevated above the art directors. In the same way in comics, All those editors at DC were all from the pulps. It was the word over the artist, over the image. Infantino comes in 1967, 68, and starts making artist editors like his contemporaries, Joe Kubert.
So let's talk about some of the other artists that are in the book.
I love them.
I'm just going to pick them at random. Gene Colan.
Ah, Gene Colan has the fewest pages in the book. Only 8 pages. My original book proposal was a 300-page book. My agent at the time laughed at me in terms of, you know how expensive that would be? You want to do a 9-inch by 13-inch oversized hardcover, blah, blah, blah. I had to edit down from 300 to 196 or 92 or something. And the point is it's like you're, you know, when you have fights over your wedding list, you can't, not everybody makes that A list. You know, and so there's a whole discussion we can have. Believe me, we can fill up a whole hour on just the editing decisions and the people I had to leave out. So Colan, out of the 8 artists in my book, has only 8 pages. And yet, before Gene passed a couple of years ago, he told me that, and it's part of the blurbs on the jacket copy of my revised edition, it's the best thing he felt had ever been done on his work. I was only able to give him 8 pages. But those 8 pages really impacted him, and it's something I'll never forget.
What is it about Colan that made him make the cut over, I don't know, I'll throw
Well, let's say
names.
John Romita.
Romita. Okay, Buscema,
perfect example.
Kurt Swan, Murphy Anderson.
You are naming, Bob, all of the artists in the 16-page chapter called More Masters of the Silver Age. Because my original book was 176 pages because the original edition had to work as a trade paperback and a hardcover. But the hardcover, the hook my original publisher wanted to put in to make people buy the hardcover, was adding an extra 16 pages. So I had to basically come up a way to finish the book conclusive in 176 pages, but in the hardcover somehow have these extra 16 pages. So I came up with the artists that didn't make the A-list. I came up with the artists you just named, Murphy Anderson, John Buscema, Wally Wood, Nick Carty, and Kurt Swan. So out of those 5, Colan beat all of them out. Why? Because for each one, there's a reason. But primarily, Colan, in his short little Marvel Silver Age era, where he really starts in 1966 – does pretty definitive versions of 3 major characters: Submariner, Iron Man, Daredevil, and you could even add his Doctor Strange is the only Doctor Strange that can really be spoken about on the same level as Steve Ditko's, and that's high praise. But right there, you've got 3 to 4 definitive versions. Romita, okay, he followed Ditko and he did a Spider-Man that a whole generation loves more than Ditko's. I'm the Ditko fan who, like many of us, believe there are only 39 issues of Spider-Man and 2 annuals. And if you know your 39 issues, it's 38 issues of Spider-Man and 1 issue of Amazing Fantasy. But Romita didn't make the cut because he only does 1 character. Buscema almost made the cut, but okay, he did the Avengers, he did the Silver Surfer. But again, Colan did, you know, 3 major, you know, versions. So I ended up giving the edge to Colan. But Buscema has 4 pages in that extra chapter. So the hardest job creatively, Bob, was the editing of – imagine the images I've left out if the book had been 300 pages. So I had to make every image in my book count, which I think if you go through the 196 pages now – I'd like to think every single spread not only is different from every other spread, but every spread counts in terms of what I'm trying to say visually with the artist's work, in terms of the context of the book, the context of their own work, and what I'm trying to say verbally in the same way that the words and pictures work together in comics. My book is basically, you read it like a giant comic book, but it's an art book and a history book.
I would just on my own taste, I would have guessed that Nick Carty would have made a tough might have finished ahead of Buscema and Romita, and might have been made a tough
absolutely
tough fight with his cover work. I mean, it's just
that's what he's got 2 pages in my book, and it is his covers. The reason why, again, he didn't make the cut, this comes down to I needed more Marvel work to offset the amount of DC I had. And Cardi was a DC artist. So Colin got the nod purely pragmatically because I needed more of a Marvel balance in those 176 pages. But Cardi, are you kidding? I could have done a whole spread on his Aquaman, a whole spread on his Teen Titans.
Right.
And I mean, you know, and then all the other covers you did. So he could have had 8 pages. The point is all of these guys, the book ends up being 300 pages,
right,
which was my original proposal. But, you know, if only Christmas was in July or whatever the expression is.
Who are the
artists? Why can't every day be – what's the expression? Why can't every day be whatever day?
Whatever day.
Yeah.
Who didn't make that bonus section? Who?
Now you're talking about the C list. If the bonus section is the B list,
yeah.
Now you're talking about who didn't make it into the. Hey, where do we begin? Where do we begin? You tell me. You tell me who I left out that should have been represented.
I know who shouldn't be represented.
But put it this way, Romita's not there.
Yeah.
So right there, Romita's not there. Who else do you think from the 60s? From the Silver Age, in terms of Marvel and DC impact, should have, you know.
That's why I'm asking you.
Because I hardly think of that. But, you know, I would say, you got Romita. I mean, and then you got to really start searching for, you know, other artists at both companies. But I'm sure, because I like to dwell more on the positive than the negative, I'm sure I could come up with probably the dozens, Bob, that didn't make it into the B list.
Well, there's one guy whose name is on my mind because I did a show on him a few months ago. I'm trying to think of who wrote the book. I think maybe it was John Coates did a book on Don Heck, and I just was like, Don Heck.
Do you know, Bob, at the Society of Illustrators that I'm a member of right now, they're having an exhibit called Dick Dillon, Comic Book Genius, and I'm telling you, the word genius is in there. And Dick Dillon, I mean, I'm sure he was a lovely gentleman. And a lot of people, especially on Facebook, in social media, they can't separate criticizing an artist's work or saying you don't like an artist's work for judging their character.
Right.
And it's like, I could care less who Dick Dillon was. His artwork turned my stomach. And the fact that he has an exhibit, he followed Mike Sikowski on Justice League of America. My point is, I'd rather be discussing the great artists than trying to talk about the bad artists.
Right, right. Well, and so, yeah, Don Heck, I was like, of all the extraordinarily average work, I just couldn't see doing a whole book on that guy. But, you know, you got to fill pages, I guess. You're a writer and – I just didn't see it.
Listen, this is no offense to Don Heck. I love his early Iron Man with the dotted helmet. But I mean, you know, like I said, this is about I've only got 176 pages. Who is the A-list?
Let me ask you this. Are there any artists in the book who you were not particularly a fan of, but you felt like you couldn't possibly leave them out?
Well, I would say every artist of the eight artists, I love them all and all for their strengths. But take Joe Kubert, for instance. When I was a kid, I was such a superhero zombie, like I think a whole generation was, that I rejected things like The Spirit when I saw it in 1966 in these Harvey Comics 25-cent annuals because I was like a superhero in a business suit with a hat. That's not a superhero.
That's Will Eisner.
and that made me not open the book and look at the contents, and my life might have changed had I discovered Will Eisner at 8 years old instead of when I was 16 years old, thanks to those Warren black and whites and whatever. My point is I was such a superhero zombie because of the DC and Marvel product. So all of a sudden, Kubert, I never looked at a war comic. It wasn't superheroes. I remember seeing Kubert growing up. But I wasn't a fan of his work because it was war. But I'll never forget staring at the cover of that Enemy Ace issue that he does in 1968, this full face in blue with the little airplanes in front of it. And it looked like a movie panel. And I remember I was 10 years old, Bob. I was so drawn to this cover. It had a magnetic hold on me, but my rational mind was telling myself, you can't buy it. It's a war comic. And I remember putting it back down in the racks and not buying it. And yet, the greatness of his art is what actually attracted me. As I got older, I grew to appreciate Joe Kubert when I got older and, you know, went back and got the Sergeant Rock work. Look, I'm pulling my book up. This is the Enemy Ace cover that I'm talking about. You see that there? Mm-hmm. So to finally pay homage to it by giving it a full page as an adult years later. So he's the best example of an artist that I just didn't read when I was a kid because of the superhero zombie hold.
And my example would have been for me, and people will hate this, but I would have picked Jack Kirby. Kirby, some extraordinary work during the early Marvel age, but so much crap too. He, you know, because he churned out the pages. There was the great stuff that you highlight. You show some incredible Fantastic Four images, for example. But there's also just a lot of crappy Jack Kirby out there.
Well, like, wait. Now, if you're going to open up that can of worms, now hold on a second. When you say crap, you're talking about in the Marvel era of the Silver Age. Yeah, Kirby did a lot of layouts, but I mean, there's also his prime work. I mean, he was doing Fantastic Four, Thor, Captain America.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, what about that? But you're just saying you didn't like the look of his work?
No, I'm saying that probably later. And maybe,
but if you're talking about now in the 70s with DC and later, but I mean, Bob, it's like, see, if we're talking about later,
yeah.
Kirby.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
That's a different story.
I've never felt the same fondness for Kirby that I did for Steranko or Adams or Colin.
And that's because why? You saw a lot of subpar Kirby work?
Yeah,
but it's not,
I think so.
But are you talking about the later work?
It might have been the later. Maybe late 60s, early 70s.
Late 60s, he was at Marvel. He wasn't at these.
All right, then it's the 70s. Look, you're the expert on this. I'm not.
Well, I'm trying, to clarify.
The DC,
it was definitely his later work.
Certainly a crap load of DC stuff from the 70s.
I agree with you.
And so, but that's what I'm saying is if it was me looking at all of these artists, he would be the one for me where I'd go, well, he has to be in there. But to look at his entirety of his work, which of course is not what you're doing, I would be like, well, I got to put him in there. But you know, I know there's going to be people who are going to be like, oh, Jack Kirby. But just the sheer volume, and it wasn't always great.
I'd rather focus on what I did and what's in the book versus what's not in the book and what I didn't do or the artists I didn't focus on.
All right, well, let's change gears a little bit. So we've talked about the artists. We've talked about the weighing who gets in versus who doesn't get in. Tell me about this a little bit. One of the things that's really, really cool about this book and that does set it apart from other books on the Silver Age, whether they be narrative histories or the art of the age, is the graphic display that you've put together for this. And you can tell that you have a graphic experience and a graphic eye. You overlaid the artist's work but replaced the character dialogue in the word balloons with comments from the artists themselves. I mean, and the first thing that struck me is, oh, my God, that must have taken – enormous amount of time.
A lifetime, one might say.
Yeah,
well, that book represents literally a lifetime of reading, looking at, studying, drawing from these comics from this era. I mean, that was my growing up. And then becoming an artist, going to art school, then working for Neil Adams and doing comic book style art professionally. I mean, I carried these art and these artists all through my, you know, growing up and into my professional career because that is my source. It's like a musician that draws upon the music that he grew up with. I mean, we all are, you know, I quote this Albert Camus at the end of my book where he says, a man's work is nothing but the slow trek to rediscover through the detours of art those two or three great and simple images in whose presence his heart first opened. And the fact that I can recite that by heart is a testament to how that a sentence by him is my raison d'etre, and it's really what, you know, the book is about, is me paying homage to these great art, the art, the artists, the period, which is an important period, and trying to do really the only book of its type, because I knew every other book. And my feeling is, you know, this is the way you have to do it, because comics are words and pictures. The fact that all history books before mine were word heavy with little reproductions, that's not true to what comics are themselves. And that's what I learned at Rhode Island School of Design, major in graphic design. We learned a concept called the concrete book, in which whatever your subject matter is, if you're the designer, every decision about that book, the typeface that you use, the way you turn the pages, the way you order the material, should reinforce what the subject matter is. So how can you do a book about comic book art history and not make it a book about the art, but also be a book that you read? And but when you read a comic, it's words and pictures. So to me, it's a no-brainer what has become my style in doing these verbal visual essays about comic book history.
Well, and that's the thing. You read this book. I wish I could have said it this well in the introduction. You read this book like it's a comic book, because like you're following it. You're going generally left,
absolutely,
right, and then down and back. And you know, the people who look at this book who did not grow up with comics, it'll probably someone will have to explain to them how to read it, because that always confuses people as adults who don't have comic book experience. But that's it. It reads like a comic book, but it reads like an art history book about comics. What I wondered is, was there any other book that you had seen that kind of inspired the style of this book?
Well, right off the top of my head, I would say The Medium is the Massage by Marshall McLuhan, the writer, but the graphic designer was a guy named Quentin Fiore. And I think it comes out in 1970 or so, black and white. I did a coffee table art book about the Twilight Zone, which in the same way that my Silver Age book is like reading a giant comic book, my Twilight Zone book, it's the only coffee table art book about the TV series, came out in 1991, before the internet, before the Sci-Fi Channel, a little ahead of its time. But the point is you read that like a little black and white TV screen. And, you know, I just lost my original point. Your question was...
other books that inspired this.
Oh, so Quentin Fiore's book, Being in Black and White. And I think the cover of the book was that Twilight Zone black and white vortex. But that book was a combination of words and pictures with photography and graphic design and making the words very visual, in the same way the words in comic books can be very visual. And guys like Steranko and Walt Simonson, you know, really excelled in making the type very visual, a la Will Eisner, who, as usual, did everything first. Eisner's the D.W. Griffith of comic book art. In fact, this year's the 75th anniversary. I'll be doing a lecture about the Spirit 75th anniversary later this summer for the Connecticut Comic Convention. But the point is it was really that book that, when I discovered it while I was studying at Rhode Island School of Design, probably made the biggest influence. So if you can find the book, research it, you'll see that it is a very graphic, page-turning experience, very much like Steranko's work, and guys like that who would play with an Eisner with the actual didactic panel arrangement and the way you turn pages and the way you see images. It can be described in filmic language as like going from close-up to long shot, zoom-ins, but it all depends on the verbal message. So it's words and pictures working together. And to me, that's the only way to do a book about comic book art, whether it's art, art history, whatever you want to call it, is you have to read it like a comic book, because that makes it, like what I was taught, a concrete book.
Hmm. Would it ever interest you to give the same treatment to the Golden Age or another era, or is this it for you?
Well, put it this way. This is where my heart is. My heart is not in the Golden Age, because I didn't grow up with that. And it's not – I mean, obviously, you know, the 1970s artists, Chaykin, you know, Simonson, Craig Russell, Barry Smith, Jim Aparo. I mean, there's a top 10 right there. If a publisher wants to hire me and pay me to do such a book, I would love to do that book. But I have other book ideas that I haven't done that I'd like to do. like bringing my Twilight Zone book back into print in the same way I brought my Silver Age book back into print. So I'd like to do those others, but again, as a freelance artist, I wouldn't turn away a proper paycheck to do a book on like the 1970s artists, treating them similar to the way I treated the 60s. But it would have to be like a real hired gun assignment. And like I said, I've got other books about comics, about pop culture that I'd like to do if I can do them first.
All right. Well, speaking of which, I know you've got a lot of speaking engagements coming up this summer and this fall.
Yeah.
I wanted to give you a minute to talk about those a little bit, if you like.
Well, I can't believe it. In almost 3 weeks, I guess, will be the San Diego Comic Convention, the biggest one in the country. And I've been lecturing there pretty much every year since 2008 or six. And they accepted my lecture about Irish Snap this year. So that'll be July 11th, I think, the Saturday, prime time at San Diego.
You better explain who Irish Snap is. I imagine a lot of people don't know.
Nobody knows this guy.
And yet,
everybody knows his work, Bob. Irish Snap is the great DC Comics hand letterer who not only refined the Superman logo, designed the Action Comics logo, designed every Silver Age DC Comics logo you could think of this, starting with the Flash, Green Lantern, Atom, everybody. Also designed the DC Bullet in the upper left corner of the comic. He designed the Comics Code seal, the stamp, in the upper right corner. And if that all wasn't enough, he designed all those house heads that we all grew up with in the DC Silver Age that are some of the most beautiful examples of hand lettering of any field, graphic design, advertising, you name it. But he also designed the Roman letters on top of the Penn Station post office in Manhattan, neither rain nor snow nor gloom of night. So he came from a family of stonecutters. Dies in 1969. Nobody knows his work. New Yorkers don't know who designed the Roman lettering. He did the Roman lettering in the public library facade as well. And yet he did the Superman logo, which is the Coca-Cola of comic book logos. So I was able to meet the head of the Type Directors Club in Manhattan, which has a nice sized space to do an exhibition. And I convinced them when I told them what I just told you about Irish Snap, they let me design an exhibit about his work. So I got to design an Irish Snap exhibit, lettering that has influenced my work since I've been a professional, and in a three-dimensional way. There's like multiple planes of sort of exhibition design going on. I got to blow up the Superman logo 14 feet long. And it's on through the summer till September 25th. So if you go to, you know, the website TDC.com, typedirectorsclub.org, information's there. But the point is I developed a lecture based on Schnapp's work, which I gave opening night in May, and that's the one that I'll be doing in San Diego. So I'll be spreading the love of Schnapp to the West Coast and planting seeds to honor this great guy that, you know, died really unknown and unmourned and everything. And here we are, you know, 40 how many years later, where I'm proud to say, because I've loved his work without even knowing who he was.
Well, how did you discover who Snap was? I mean,
you know, over the years, as, you know, the online world developed and information got out, I had heard his name here and there, but it never really registered. In 2006, a guy named Robbie Reed, which is a pseudonym, has a comics history site called Dial B for Blog, and he does a 10-part series on Irish Snap that just blows my mind. And I actually dedicate my exhibit to Robbie Reed and Dial B for Blog. And the point is we got in touch, we talked about Snap. The only DC letterer I remember hearing was Joe, and you can't make this up, he's Italian. Joe Letterese, L-E-T-E-R-E-S-E. I mean, how do you make that up, right?
Yep.
So, but again, I had heard Irish Snap over the years. I wasn't really sure what, but it was really Robbie Reed's thing that did it. But I had been copying Snap's lettering style my whole career before that, again, without really knowing it was him. So he's been an influence in my life. But thanks to the Robbie Reed thing, I got to know about the Roman lettering in Penn Station and the New York Library and other aspects of his life. The other interesting thing is that I worked for Neil Adams, and Neil Adams was a young Turk at DC Comics in the late 60s working in the production office where he liked to work and draw those early covers for DC, 1967, 68. Well, he remembers talking with Ira Schnapp, because Ira Schnapp was on his way out in 1968 as Adams was really just coming in. But he recalls Schnapp bringing in these giant tracing paper images of Roman letters that he would draw big to give to the stonecutters for them to cut out with. So I worked for Neil Adams, and either I remembered him telling me, but I had forgotten it. I don't know what, but all that information surfaced, you know, later, thanks to Robbie Reed.
All right. Well, look, before we let you go, a couple little things we need to touch on. You're a guy who's got Elvis sideburns, and it looks like you're wearing a cape. You want to, without, you know, without, yeah.
Don't worry.
Show us what's going on here.
Well, basically, if you see this, this was a belt buckle that I repurposed as this sort of Dr. Doom-esque medallion. I went to the hardware store, got that, went to a seamstress, and she sewed it on, because this is basically, let me just do this.
Okay, yeah. Be careful with you.
Can you see the Superman yellow?
It's Super Schumer, yeah.
You saw the Superman yellow S?
Yep, Super Schumer.
Well, that's really a DC licensed cape, but I gave it what I call the Roman Centurion Dr. Doom look that you want in a man's evening cape, as I like to think of this.
Very nice. And then,
hey,
and the Elvis sideburns?
Oh, you know, I've been drawing these sideburns since I was a kid. And when you grew up in the late 60s, you know, Neil Adams was drawing hip characters. So I always wanted – I was never an Elvis fan. I really grew up and became the biggest Bruce Springsteen fan. I was art director of his first fan magazine when I was at Rhode Island School of Design.
Wow.
But I was never really a big Elvis fan because, again, emotionally, he never really touched my life. I came of age really with Bruce more than like a Bob Dylan even. But yeah, I've always sort of liked these sort of sideburns.
All right. And now let's see what we can do about pointing out some things behind you. First of all, I got to ask, to your right, I see a specter. Is that Jim Aparo's specter, or is that somebody else's specter?
Now, if you're talking about the image on the wall, that's Murphy. That's Murphy Anderson.
Oh, okay, yeah, I couldn't see it well enough to be sure.
That's the Silver Age rebirth of the Spectre, early 1966. But there's a little statue right below it that DC came out with a few years ago, based on whoever, you know, like the Alex Ross Spectre. Mm. But he's standing on top of a little tin that came with the Superman little statuette. And the reason why I group Superman with the Spectre is that they were both created by Jerry Siegel, the writer. He created the Spectre as well as co-created Superman, you know, with the artist Joe Shuster.
And who's Batman? I think that's Batman directly behind you and up a little bit in blue. Is that Batman?
That one, yeah, that one up there. Let's see, I can point it up a little.
Okay. Oh, that's good.
That is a great Steve Rude version of Batman.
Wow.
That I think actually is supposed to hang like vertically, which I've never done this. I like the image better as a horizontal. Mm. I think his signature, the image is supposed to be turned this way, but I like it better that way. I normally have never done that. If I look at all the art in my apartment, I don't think I've done that with any other piece except that. But I love Steve Rude so much. You know, you see the other Rude next to it, the world's finest?
Oh, yeah, that's a beautiful piece, yeah.
And then I've got Green Hornet and Kato, Batman and Robin.
I have that Green Hornet and Kato on the bookshelf myself. And is that got the mask, too.
Bob?
Yep.
How about this, the Green Hornet mask?
Oh, that's awesome.
Come on.
Very nice. And I see you have another favorite of mine. You have Doc Savage back there.
Oh, that's the great James Bama. Really, to me, I can wax rhapsodic on Bama ad nauseum. But of all the Bama 67 Doc Savage paperback covers,
World's
Fair Goblin is, to me, the single greatest Doc Savage image, the greatest lighting, the perfect pose. I mean, not only are Bomb is Doc Savage the greatest, like, kind of modern vision of the heroic male figure, not only in American pop culture in the 20th century, but I would say in the history of art itself. Bomb's images of Doc Savage rival anybody's. I'd put him up against Michelangelo and have no problem saying that.
I had the entire paperback set of those, and also the shadow paperbacks for a long time. It's beautiful.
By Steranko?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great stuff. And then the last one, who did the Superman to your left there?
Ah, that's Alex Ross, painter's man.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I've got there's a lot of Alex Ross around me because he had the most impact in terms of raising the bar on realism in the mainstream superhero style, really since Neil Adams, who was a big influence. The way Neil Adams and Pen and Ink created new visions of realism in heroic imagery, that's really what Ross did, but he took it up a notch into painting and really carried the torch into realism. So it looks like, you know, the greatest actor that DC could never find to play Superman somehow in the perfect build and the billowing cape and everything. That's what makes Ross Ross.
Well, it's exciting to me that Dynamite's bringing out the Spirit this summer again, and they've got Alex Ross to do covers. I think that's very cool.
I wish he would do an interior. I mean, I love his covers, but man, I would love to see him do a Spirit interior.
Yeah, that would be nice. Well, you're going out to San Diego. Talk to those people.
Yeah, Ross never even comes to conventions. The guy's so busy, he literally doesn't have the time, or at least his representatives say, he doesn't even have the time to go to San Diego, the biggest convention in the country.
Yeah, well, you know, those of us who are busy never make it out there.
Yeah, hello. Exactly.
All right, folks, listen. You can find Arlen Shumer's revised edition of The Silver Age of Comic Book Art in great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. If you're watching on the main site, MrMedia.com, below the video, either to the left or to the right, I haven't decided yet, it's a little early, you'll see the cover of the book. Click on it. It'll take you to Amazon, you'll get a great price on it, and you know, with the drones, they can have it to you in 30 minutes or less, I think that's what they're saying now. So order that. You can order any of Arlen's other available books the same way. Arlen, I know that you are very active on Facebook and comic forums. Is that a place where people can track you down and make contact?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on Facebook just under my name, Arlen Shumer. They could come join my book based on my group, based on my book, The Silver Age of Comic Book Art. I also run an alternate group just for Neil Adams called the Neil Adams Almanac. And those are really we get in some great comics history discussions.
Right. And do you have a website as well?
Yeah, I wanted to mention that, you know, if you want to get a signed and sketched in version of my book directly from me, just go to my website, arlenshumer.com. And from that page, they can link to the rest of my website. But that's the best place to get all things Arlen Shumer.
Well, and who doesn't want that, damn it?
Tell me about it.
Look, folks, again, it's a beautiful, it's a gorgeous book. I mean, if you have any interest in comic book art at all, you got to get this book. Arlen, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Yep. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and to see your workspace. And thank you so much for joining us in Mr. Media today.
Bob, thanks for having me on. It's been great. I've adopted Charles Schulz's I Love Mankind. It's people I can't stand. Present company excluded, Bob.
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Shirok guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, their reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Meltzer crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot.
Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
The distance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.